A Genealogy of Ideas, the podcast. I'm Michaela Lance Simmons. This podcast was conceived to accompany an e-journal series created by the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding. Dr. Jane Dougherty and I are the authors. In this episode, you'll hear a conversation between Dr. Lisa Shirk and Dr. Catherine Barnes on significant shifts they have seen and advocated for in the developing field of peacebuilding. It wasn't until recently that conflict resolution or conflict transformation was a field of study. Lisa and Catherine jumped on board right as the academic field of peacebuilding was being institutionalized.
And I remember we had a really small entering class at George Mason University's Institute of Conflict Analysis and Resolution. I think there were only like 12 of us or something. I can't remember exactly.
This is Catherine Barnes.
But we had all of our classes together. And I remember how exciting it was because we were carrying forward these ideas and themes that we were getting from different classes and having conversations that would begin in one class and continuing over to the next class. Mm-hmm. And it was almost this feeling like we were synthesizing and helping to kind of give birth to this as an academic field.
Here's Lisa Shirk.
We came to our graduate program at George Mason University with experience working at the community level. You working in the Appalachian region, I was working in Canada with First Nations and land claims, Aboriginal rights, very much from a social justice background, you as a Quaker and me as a Mennonite. And I think that our value framework also really interacted in a unique way with the field of conflict resolution and analysis where it was at in the 1980s. As we came to class, we were pushing professors, I think, in looking at religion and values and ethics. Certainly Jim Lowy was a strong ally in terms of those social justice experiments and experiences, because he had been part of the civil rights movement, had worked with Martin Luther King, and that to me felt more familiar perhaps than some of the negotiation mediation field as it had developed in the United States at that point.
You know, when you're thinking back on this, where do you, and from, you know, where you're sitting and your experience, see the origins of societally based peace building as we've come to know it?
Right. So, I mean, the field of conflict resolution, conflict transformation, conflict management, peace building, whatever you want to call it, restorative justice, these things started in civil society decades ago. The genetic code has evolved. Here in the United States, it was in the civil rights movement, really moved from thinking about community organizing into conflict resolution and public problem solving. But in other countries in the Southern Hemisphere, it was developing very rapidly because they often were in countries where the state was not really providing public services to citizens. There was a big vacuum, and civil society began building institutions and social movements, first of all, to challenge the state in the fact that it was often corrupt and elite-focused, but also in building up institutions and services because the state wasn't providing education and healthcare. So you really saw the growth of civil society in the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, as many more organizations, religious organizations, church-based, mosque-based service programs, because the state wasn't providing for people's needs. So civil society grew in part because the state was kind of absent or corrupt. And in some of these countries, civil society specifically developed peace and security functions, again, because there were no states governing conflicts and tribal issues, land conflicts, water conflicts. Civil society began mediating using traditional cultural-based dialogue, negotiation, mediation methods.
I think one of the things that we were both seeing and both witness to was this gap between what was happening at the policy level and the official institutions and what was happening on the ground. I think it was happening on the ground in places where people would see, okay, there's all sorts of stuff happening in these spaces that societies were picking up and moving with, but they weren't formalized. The period after 2000, where you started having the beginnings of new approaches coming. I know one of the projects that I was involved with was trying to say, can we build in ways of looking at peace negotiations that involve public participation, not elite level bargaining?
The emergence of the Nairobi Peace Initiative is one of the earliest examples in the early 1980s of the institutionalization that civil society had expertise in peace and security and could really maneuver and bring things together in a way the state did not have the capacity for. And it was not a challenge to the state, it was a compliment to the state. Civil society in Kenya today has incredibly mushroomed, thousands of NGOs, National Council of Churches, universities, labor movements, so many different parts of civil society, so not just foreign NGOs, they're probably the smallest part, indigenous civil society groups where people are organizing on behalf of public interests, creating institutions, creating movements, and working to make a better life.
Then you had in 2001 Kofi Annan's report on conflict prevention, and he actually, or the UN system agreed at that point in time that civil society really did have a role and we did have to start talking about more inclusive peace processes and more inclusive societally based approaches to conflict prevention. And so there was the request, I think in part because there hadn't been a UN conference on civil society and peace and security issues, there was actually even a request in that report, could civil society organize a conference to right. talk about its role in these things? And so the process that you and I both became a part of, which was the Global Partnership for the Prevention of Armed Conflict, which was, I think, you know, Paul von Tongeren and the European Center for Conflict Prevention sort of saying, okay, hey, wait a minute, here's an opportunity. Shall we seize it? And then beginning what became quite an interesting process of trying to get in touch with all of these different kinds of significant peace-building organizations that had institutionalized themselves, had begun to build that, but were very much based in regions and didn't have a profile so much at the UN level. How to have regional conferences for saying what are the priorities, what are the agendas at the regions, and then coming to New York to have a global conference in July 2005. And so I've helped to facilitate that process in some of the regional conferences as well as the global process. So you were an advisor to that process. Mm-hmm. And I think that in a way that helped to officially make visible the fact that already existed on the ground, mm-hmm. which was all the roles that were being played mm-hmm. and all of their complexity and all of their creativity by local civil society mm-hmm. peace-building organizations, and was trying to, in a way, flesh out what had already begun to be some mm-hmm. changes in the international policy discourse mm-hmm. on peace and security issues.
South Africa today has some of the most sophisticated peace building architecture in the world because they have grown it from their own experience. They organized, they did community organizing, protest movements, and now they're making policy proposals, they're doing conflict resolution, conflict transformation at the national level in their own country and all over Africa and in the world. That happened in Guatemala, in Brazil, and many parts of Asia where sort of these internal civil society movements have become institutionalized into peace-building, civil society-based organizations that are now incredibly experienced, have a significant capacity to contribute to peace and security.
This conversation was recorded in spring 2016. Thanks go to Aaron Oda for the music and James and Marion Payne for supporting this project.